welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. My name is Christopher Harris. I'm joined on the panel today with Kartik Krishnayar. Kartik, it just seems so surreal to discuss this, but this is episode 1,400. It's a huge number, and it's taken us 16 years to get here. it's crazy when you think about it, 1,400. What are your thoughts when people say 1,400 episodes?
Wow, I mean, there's no real historic precedent for it because we were one of the first major soccer podcasts and really the only one of those independent podcasts that began when podcasts first became a thing and people were getting iPods and getting other MP3 type players to listen to podcasts on. Remember, podcasts originally were these kind of things that you would have to download. You'd have to go through some sort of extensive process to download them onto your MP3 device. We're the only independent soccer podcast that I know of that was around in 2006 that is still around. And so the enormity of that, and obviously we've gone through format changes. I know some listeners will point that out, multiple format changes. But the enormity of that is just, it's hard to put into context. And we're still here. We're going strong, maybe stronger than ever. So it's really quite an accomplishment for everybody who's been involved with World Soccer Talk and our podcast, which include a number of people who maybe people who are newer listeners don't realize were associated with our podcast in the early days, who've gone on to careers outside of World Soccer Talk.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because Carl Fansler, who's our other host, who does the Monday episode, usually interviews or big topic discussions, he joined World Soccer Talk back in September. And he said to me, he was going through some of the old podcast episodes, and he's like, oh my gosh, Lawrence McKenna was part of World Soccer Talk. And I was like, yeah, he was. He kind of basically started with World Soccer Talk and was doing the podcast, and that evolved into doing a lot of video work. And oftentimes we do some video documentaries with him going to Milan or different places in Europe. He did some interviews for us on video, and that basically through that he was able to establish a really good networks and contacts with people in London that were doing podcasts, and they were doing like the Football Ramble, for example. They were good friends with them, and that evolved from there. And that's just one person out of many that we've had in the past that have gone on to even bigger and better things. But it's interesting too, Kartik, because when you think about podcasts in general, when we started this podcast in 2006, the reason we did it at that point really was because if you wanted to talk about soccer from a fan's point of view, that was the only outlet, because at that time there was Fox Soccer Channel, which was showing all the games, but they didn't really have any kind of fan user-generated content or kind of fan voice there. And the closest they got to that was probably Fox Football Phone-In, where people would call in with questions or their input or kind of ranting and raving about Liverpool or whoever it may be. And it's interesting how podcasts in general have evolved from that early days, 2006 or so, to now where it's mainstream. You've got Hulu with Steve Martin and Martin Short having a series, Only Murders in the Building, which was fantastic, focused on podcasts and how they're generating podcasts and trying to solve this murder. You had, of course, the Serial podcast that was very successful a few years ago. Podcasts are mainstream. Even the word podcast, though, when you think about it, who listens to podcasts now on an iPod? That goes to show how old podcasts are. What's been your experience, Kartik, with podcasts in general? Have your habits changed, or do you listen to podcasts as much as you did before than in the past?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I do, but there was a huge dip in the middle. So 2006, 2007, when we started, I was listening to podcasts constantly, downloading them in kind of a cumbersome way to my MP3 player. I don't think I actually had an iPod until 2007 or 2008, so I had, you know, other company MP3 players. So you would have to go through sort of hoops to download it into iTunes and then convert it, all of that stuff. So I was listening to a ton of podcasts in 2007, 2008, 2009. Really dropped off in my podcast listening until 2016 or 2017, I would say, and have been listening to podcasts constantly, probably more than ever since then. But there was a gap in the middle, and I think there was generally a gap in the middle with podcasts also, where people were returning to more traditional media or watching videos instead, right? There was that gap. And then I think when Apple did their own podcast app, and Spotify had a lot to do with the regrowth of podcasts, and then these other very good podcast apps came out. I happen to use Overcast. That's the podcast app I prefer. But I know others who prefer Apple or prefer Spotify, whoever. That really kind of stimulated another growth in podcast, where I'm listening to podcasts constantly. And in fact, now discovered probably 3 or 4 years ago the genre of history podcasts. I think it was 2018 or so I discovered that, and have been hooked on historical podcasts, which I guess had been in the ether since 2007, 2008, and I had just never really discovered them. So it's funny. Podcasts have gone through these ebbs and flows, too, and it's not like any other medium. I mean, we know movies. Hollywood took a real hit once television became very mainstream in the 1950s and bounced back with a vengeance in the 1960s, right? So new technology becomes old technology, becomes kind of stale at times, and then reinvigorates itself. And I think podcasts have gone through very much the same.
Yeah, so we will get to the news in a second. But it is one of those things that's interesting for me, at least personally, is if I'm going on a road trip and I switch on the radio and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. Like, I'm going from, and it seems to be sometimes like, I mean, 10 minutes before the hour, I'm kind of flipping, hitting the tune button to go through different stations. And sometimes you've got it where every single radio station's on a commercial break. And I'm like, oh, come on. So then I go to a podcast, and then for me, you know what I mean? I can pick and choose what I want to listen to, whether it's music or podcasts, whatever it may be, and really enjoy it. I mean, to me, it's changed the listening experience. And it's very much like, I guess one of the advantages of the internet really is with the podcast in general. Now, speaking of podcasts, Kartik, let's talk about this week's show. So I know you were traveling last weekend, and we're not going to go into a lot of detail about this, but it was, to me, one of the most entertaining Premier League weekends. There were some really, really amazing goals scored. There were some good games. And because of the Winter Olympics, this was probably, to me, at least personally, one of the worst weekends of NBC's coverage of the Premier League in a long time. I can't even remember how long. I mean, one example was just for the Man City Spurs game. Massive game. There was no pregame. There's no pregame show. So at 12 o'clock, the Crystal Palace-Chelsea game had ended. That coverage had ended at 12. So I was expecting from 12 to 12:30, either on Peacock or on NBC, all USA, to have 30 minutes of pregame. Like, hey, what a game that was. Here's our pregame coverage for Man City Spurs. And instead on NBC, there was an infomercial. USA, I'm sure, had the Olympics, although I don't think there was anything live happening at that time. And Peacock had nothing. And Arlo and Lee Dixon and Graeme Lasso were in the Sky Sports studio in London, and they could have easily done, I would think, they could have easily done 30 minutes of pregame on Peacock. There was nothing. It was really strange. And at 12:30, as soon as the game kicked off, it was Arlo White talking for the first 10 or 15 seconds. And then when the game had already kicked off, and then went right into Peter Drury and Jim Beglin doing the actual commentary. Yeah, thank God the Winter Olympics is over. Hopefully normal service will resume this week. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. So, Kartik, one of the things I want to talk to you about, though, too, is Liverpool, of course, won midweek. And now that race for the Premier League at the top, what's your thoughts on this? I mean, you're a Man City fan. Are you feeling confident that City is still going to go ahead and win the title based on what the team's doing right now?
I think it's more based on what Liverpool's doing. I mean, Liverpool have gone out and signed a really high-end attacker during the winter window. Man City's only move on that front was to move for Ferran Torres, who could have helped this team out to Barcelona. Sold them at a massive profit. Not complaining about that from a business perspective. But Man City do not have very much depth. As you saw in this Spurs match, I know there's this narrative, although I guess it's kind of changing. I think people are kind of wising up to it, that City has all this money and they have such a deep team. As you saw, Guardiola used one sub against Spurs while chasing the game. One sub. There's not even enough guys on the bench, I think, really to change things up during a match anymore. Now, once Jack Grealish gets his head out of his rear end and maybe starts behaving like a professional and Foden cuts out some of the extracurricular stuff too, maybe then that adds some layers of depth to you. Maybe Cole Palmer is a youngster who's been injured who maybe could help. But yeah, I'm not feeling very confident, and it's not any sort of indictment of how City have played. I think they played perfectly fine. I think that they've got 14 or 15 guys that are really high level, but you also have an issue where you don't have a number nine. You don't have really an out-and-out goal scorer in the team. Let's be honest about it. You're relying on goals from midfield, which you get a lot of, which, by the way, City get a lot more of than Liverpool. So if there's one concern I would have about Liverpool is that they don't really have a goal-scoring midfielder, and that was the same concern I had about them last season, that they did, especially now with Wijnaldum having moved on, they get some goals. Like Fabinho got a goal recently from midfield, so they and Henderson can score from midfield, but they don't have the Gundogan, De Bruyne, Bernardo type character in midfield. You saw this week Pep made the change, puts Bernardo up top against Spurs. That didn't work, right? That took him out of his game. He got less touches than he's used to getting, and that affected the way City played. So there are limited options up top for Manchester City. I'm not crying poverty at all. Obviously, City has had the money to spend. They've chosen not to. Pep likes a certain type of player. He likes a player that will fit his system, and so there's some limitations to that. That having been said, it feels like Liverpool might be going too good, that there might be some sort of hiccup coming. I know they have a match. They still have to go to the Emirates. That's going to be a very difficult match. City have two really tough matches left, one against Liverpool at the Etihad, the other against Manchester United at the Etihad, where over the course of the last decade, Manchester City has played worse against United at home than they have at Old Trafford. Much worse. Compare the records. You'd probably be shocked if you're not aware of that. City generally play better on United's home ground versus United than at home. So there's causes for concern. It is a real title race. The thing that I think is most glaring to me, though, is this is the title race I predicted. I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, but I said before the season Liverpool would win the title. I thought City would run them close. It's actually the reverse in the table now, right? City's ahead and Liverpool running them close. And that Chelsea and United, for all their spending, to me, were unsettled squads without a clear style of play, without any sort of clear continuity, and that has happened. Chelsea way back, United even further back. So I'm actually not surprised by the season, right? But I think it's shocked a lot of people, particularly Chelsea with their heavy spending, that they're not able to finish higher than third in the league at any point in the last 5 years. And that's something, again, I'm not surprised about, but I know the analysts really are.
So Kartik, I mean, the title race in the Premier League, I think, is really interesting. But to me, actually, me personally, as a neutral, not supporting any club in the Premier League, the relegation race is the one that I think is going to come right down to the wire. It's interesting because you look at some of these clubs, and many of them have been on a good run of form. Norwich has picked up some points. Watford's been... They did get one win, but they're still suffering there. But Burnley has won a couple of games. Newcastle's on a run. Everton is dropping, except for they did get one win recently. Leeds is plummeting. Brentford's plummeting. So out of those, like, basically seven or eight clubs, even Aston Villa's in 13th spot. I mean, so out of those, I mean, if you had to make a prediction, I mean, who do you think would be going down out of those?
Well, I've said all season long I thought Burnley would stay up, and I'm sticking with that. I know that prediction has looked suspect at times. I even stuck with that during the transfer window, saying, look, they got Weghorst, who to me is a better signing than any signing Newcastle made. I thought Newcastle would go down even with those signings, but I have to say they've... they've been better than I expected. So I think they might stay up now. I'm going to say they're going to stay up. I'm saying, sticking with my preseason and your long prediction that Burnley would stay up, I have unlimited faith in Sean Dyche as an organizer, as a manager. I think they have a veteran squad that's been through this sort of fight before. I think them keeping Tarkowski, to me, is like a new signing in a way, even though he will be gone in the summer, because that I assumed he would get sold either in the summer or January window, and now they're picking up the results I've expected them to pick up. I'm not surprised they beat Spurs. I'm not surprised they picked up some other, beat Brighton, some other results. So who does that leave? That leaves Norwich, who I think will go down. Dean Smith's done a great job, but they don't have enough quality. Similar to what I said on TalkSport last night. I was on TalkSport last night talking the championship, as I often am, and host Paul Ross asked me about Peterborough, and I said, look, Darren Ferguson's done everything he could. It's very similar to Norwich in the Premier League, but they just don't have enough quality. So Norwich is going to go down. Watford, it's tough because they have Roy Hodgson now, and they have three really good attacking players, but the rest of the team is kind of suspect, right? And they can leak goals. So maybe they go down just because there's so many other good squads. And then I'm going to say Leeds. I have to give a hat tip to our friend Jonathan Starling, who used to be on this podcast in one of its previous iterations, who before the season told me Leeds would go down. And I told him, no way. And he said, oh, it's a second year syndrome. Bielsa wants guys who play his way. He hasn't really signed anyone that's going to influence things. We didn't expect Bamford to be out for this length of time, but I think Leeds will be the third team. It could be Everton. So I would put, I would say Everton have a better shot of going down than Burnley or Newcastle. Maybe I'm going to regret saying that, but I still am not sure the culture is right at Everton, and they have players. This is the important thing about Everton, where maybe actually Leeds have an edge on Everton. Leeds have had a lot of guys who've been in the championship who fought to get promoted. Everton has a group of players who've largely played for larger clubs, right, bigger clubs, have never been through anything remotely resembling a relegation fight, most of them. So Richarlison might be an exception. Although the couple of years Richarlison was at Watford were the years they weren't fighting relegation. So actually, I stand by that. So I think Everton, from a mental and psychological standpoint, also having a manager who's never been through that, also, they might be at a disadvantage. But I'm still going to say Leeds go down instead of Everton. But I'm giving my case as to why I think Everton might very well get sucked in and go down.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, we're talking about these teams here. There's about seven teams. If you include Villa in that, that's eight. I mean, a little bit of a ways off, but not that far away from the danger zone. And then even Leicester. I mean, Leicester could get pulled into it, right, in terms of their form.
Yeah. So, Chris, that's one thing to watch. I know when I threw that out on Twitter earlier in the week, people said, oh, they have 27 points. They won't go down. But think about this. Burnley and Newcastle are both coming good at the right time. So they both might pick up 10, 15 more points. It's very possible. Then you've got Leicester, who finished the last two seasons really poorly. We know that two seasons ago, they fell from second to fifth. Last season, they fell from third to fifth. They have players, again, who have not been through a relegation fight. This isn't the same Leicester of 2016. A couple guys, Albrighton and Vardy, are left from the 15 team that fought relegation. And they're the two key guys left from the title-winning team in 16. I think the people who push back on me probably are right. They get 7 to 10 more points and are safe, but it's like, I don't know, because they if you take all the teams you discussed, Villa, Everton, maybe with the exception of Leeds, Villa, Everton, Newcastle, Watford, Norwich, Burnley, I throw Leicester in there. Leicester is probably the worst team on form of those teams. At least, and they have had a horrible tendency this year, Chris, to ship goals late, which is very uncharacteristic of a Rodgers team. I would love to see a table for how many points they've dropped from winning or drawing positions this season. I bet it's the most in the league. It feels like it's the most in the league in many, many years, actually. So there's something not right with Leicester. And maybe all these trips to Europa League and Thursday nights the last few seasons have finally taken a toll on them. But yeah, so that's a good shout. I'm glad you mentioned Leicester, because I am concerned about them.
Plus injuries, too. I mean,
The injuries. That's what impacted. Killed them the last 2 years. And they would have been in the Champions League if it wasn't for injuries. And that's another issue broader topic, maybe not for today, but I would love to address at some point, is why has Rodgers had a club the last 3 years that have had a disproportionate number of injuries compared to the rest of the league? Is there something in his training? Is there something in the way Leicester plays, or is it just bad luck? Because this is the third straight year Leicester have had a disproportionate number of injuries. I mean, heck, last season, people who follow me on Twitter know this and would go back and forth with me, particularly Liverpool fans, about it, that I thought Leicester coming into the season were almost as good as City or Liverpool, but they had so many injuries, right? If you took the table in just in matches where Vardy, Tielemans, and Ndidi all played, they were as good as Man City, who won the league. But they have had so many injuries for so many successive seasons. I'm really concerned about maybe it's something with the manager himself, which you had him at Swansea. Did you guys have a lot of injuries then like this?
Not that I remember. You mean so? Not that I remember. No. But then again, it's, you mean playing in the Championship versus playing in the Premier League.
Yeah.
I mean, Rodgers was in charge of Swansea in the early days of the Premier League when Swansea were there. But no. So maybe it's something, I don't know. Yeah,
maybe it's Leicester itself. Maybe it's those players are injury prone. That could
perhaps
be right.
Perhaps. But yeah, there you go, Kartik. So you mentioned like nine different teams that have the possibility of getting kind of sucked into that relegation. The two that I'm pretty confident will get relegated are Brentford, who are on a free fall.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Leeds. I mean, I so want Leeds to stay up. But defensively, I mean, we saw that midweek. They're so poor.
Yeah, of course, you're right. I'm sorry. I completely forgot Brentford. And I've been saying for a while that I think Brentford might go down. So actually, with that in mind, Watford might get out. If Brentford does go down, if it's Brentford and Leeds, I tend to agree with you on that. Now that I don't know why I blanked out on Brentford. Then I think the third team is Norwich. Dean Smith, again, has done a great job, but they don't have much quality. Same as my Peterborough analogy in the Championship. It would be Watford who gets out. And look, I don't think Roy Hodgson would have taken this job if he didn't think he could get Watford out of it. Why would he come out of retirement? If he was willing to come out of retirement, why didn't Everton contact him? That's a whole other issue. But yeah, you're probably right. Brentford, and Brentford, by the way, have played, I think, three or four more games than Burnley, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have the table in front of me, but
yeah, three more games. Wow.
Yeah. They're in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the third team. So I think Brentford leads. And then the third team, I so want Norwich. I think Norwich has the potential of getting out of this mess. But if Norwich gets out of this mess, then it might be Everton that gets. So you imagine Everton, Leeds, and Brentford going down. It would just be, I mean, complete disaster.
So for those who don't know, Everton have been in the top flight longer consecutively than any other club in England other than Arsenal. Of course, Arsenal is one of the handful of clubs in Europe that have never been relegated from the top flight. So Everton have the second longest top flight run currently, which is at about 70 years, 1955. Let me do quick math. What is that? 67 years or so consecutively in the top flight. They have spent the most seasons overall in the top flight in England. But of course, they're an older club than Arsenal. But they are they have been in the top flight more consecutive seasons than any of the so-called big six other than Arsenal, more than Liverpool, their local rivals, who were promoted under Bill Shankly a little later, a couple years after Everton came back up for the last time, for the most recent time, more than United, who obviously got relegated in the 1970s, Chelsea in the 80s got relegated multiple times, so Man City in the 90s got relegated multiple times. So you have a really unprecedented situation with Everton Football Club, and I tend to think now, Chris, that this is maybe Everton's sort of natural level, and the David Moyes years just had Everton punching above their weight. That in the modern Premier League, maybe Everton is not as big a club as we thought it was, and that basically they had just a brilliant manager who had them finishing fifth and sixth in the league every year when another manager there, I mean, Walter Smith almost did get them relegated, right? So another manager might have gotten them relegated.
Yeah, that one is a tricky one though, Kartik, because you mean what do you base a Premier League club on? You mean do you base it on the stadium, the history, the facilities? Because there's a lot of teams that definitely punch above their weight. There's a lot of teams that punch below their weight, but Everton, I mean, if you look historically speaking, Everton should be in the top five British teams.
They were one of the big five when the Premier League began, which is another thing. I did a space on this a couple of weeks ago and found that, unfortunately, I did a Twitter space, and you're not talking about Manchester United, no one shows up. So like 15 people show up. But we talked about it, and we had some Everton fans on there, and we talked about that look, they were a big five club. They were the other big club, really, in the 1980s, outside of Liverpool and Arsenal. And Arsenal is the only English club that have been, little history lesson here, Arsenal are the only English club that's been good in every era since they started. So as big as we think Man United and Liverpool have been, they have had dips. Yeah. So in the 1980s, outside of Liverpool, who were the best club in Europe at the time, and Arsenal, who have been good in every era, Everton was that third team. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty recently, relatively speaking. That's coming into the Premier League era. They were the other big club. They're bigger historically than Aston Villa, which we think of as a huge club. And they're much bigger historically than even Leeds, who we think of as a massive club. So it would be kind of unprecedented. That having been said, I guess they haven't had the recent success or the breakthrough kind of iconic moments for a lot of newer fans who look back at history that Villa and Leeds have had, those two clubs I mentioned. So we tend to think of Leeds as a bigger club than Everton in this era. We tend to think of Villa as a bigger club than Everton, but they're really not historically. I mean, Leeds has been a yo-yo club for much of its history. Aston Villa, despite winning the European Cup in 1982 and being the biggest club in Birmingham, which is one of the largest cities in the country, has spent much of its history in the second division. Everton has not. If you look historically, just a consistency in the top flight, Chris, Everton would be not only top five, as you said, they're top two with Arsenal. It's them and Arsenal.
So we will talk about some other topics other than the Premier League in this podcast. So listeners, if you're thinking, okay, is this a Premier League podcast? but it's interesting, too, because like this week, Kartik, we've had Copa Libertadores, CONCACAF Champions League, UEFA Champions League.
Listeners, and I mean,
we've had the She Believes Cup. And even though all these different tournaments and competitions are happening,
all these different things,
and of course leagues from around the world, it keeps on coming back to the Premier League in terms of
MLS and USL.
I mean, how right now it is entertaining. It is so much to talk about.
Economics, what's happened in the last 5 to 7 years in the sport, maybe even predates that, but really kicking in the last 5 to 7 years. It's the elite competition. I'm sorry. And it's Chris, we're having this long conversation. 3-4 years ago, I could have had this same sort of in-depth conversation about other leagues in Europe. Now, it's like, I admit, my viewing habits have changed because of the Premier League hegemony. I'm not missing any matches. I mentioned earlier in the season, this week I missed matches because I was traveling. But earlier in the season, and I've been doing it until this past week, going back on Peacock once the matches are available and watching every single match in its entirety from this league. Every single match. When I'm watching, you know, snippets here and there and maybe one match here and there from other leagues. So I hate to admit it, my viewing habits have changed because this league has become so much so predominant compared to other leagues. Now, these things are cyclical, and there probably will be a cycle where it swings back soon. But for now, because of where the TV money is, my interest in the Premier League is much, much higher than it's ever been, honestly, relative to other leagues.
It's interesting, though, Carter, because you mentioned the word cosmopolitan, and you could argue that the Premier League itself is very cosmopolitan. You've got two of the best players from the continent of Africa playing in the Premier League, playing for the same team. You've got players from the South American continent. You've got Luis Diaz, who's hit the ground running from Porto to Liverpool, but I mean, looking really, really good. You've got some of the best Brazilian players playing in the Premier League. You've got the best American player, arguably, playing in England. And you go on and go around the world, and you can kind of pick and choose the different continents, and you see many of those players playing at the highest level in this league.
The only exception, I think, would be Eastern Europe, where I think the best Eastern European players are in either the Bundesliga or Serie A currently. But there are a few in the Premier League, especially, but there's still more in Italy and Germany and from that part of the world.
Right, I agree with you. But then, like, kind of West Ham United and David Moyes seems to be kind of hell-bent on picking up a lot of these Eastern European players.
Right? Yeah, yeah, right. That's true.
Yeah.
And you could argue, actually, maybe I refine that statement. You could argue Souček in particular. I know he's not getting the goals this year he's gotten in previous years, but that's not – you have to look at his overall game. You could argue he's the best Eastern European player. Just, you know, his overall game, he's just an indispensable box-to-box guy,
yep.
Central midfielder.
And then you got Kai Havertz, I mean, Timo Werner, who's still trying to find his form, but, But anyway, let's move on a little bit, Kartik. Let's look at this weekend. What match would you recommend the listeners watch, and what are you going to be watching? Looking forward to.
So sentimentally, I want to recommend Blackburn QPR, which is a huge match in the Championship, 7:30 a.m. ESPN Plus on Saturday. The issue is both those teams have hit a run of bad form. A couple of weeks ago, it looked like that would be a match to determine automatic promotion. Instead, I think it's a match to stay in the Championship playoff picture, right? Both teams. QPR will make the playoffs, but for Blackburn, it may be even just to stay in the top six. So not recommending that. I'm going to recommend Barca Athletic Club on ESPN Plus, 3 p.m. on Sunday. This is an important match, I think, psychologically for Barcelona, because they have had such a problem with Bilbao the last couple years, both in the league and in cup competitions, and it's kind of become sort of a bogey team for them, and some really high profile losses or eliminations at the hands of Athletic. So that I think is a big game psychologically for Barcelona.
So this weekend is the opening weekend of Major League Soccer, and I looked through the fixtures and I couldn't really find anything that really enthralled me or kind of got me like thinking, okay, that's going to be a great match to watch. I think for MLS this season, I'm going to be watching a lot of different games, but it's going to be one of those things where it's like, hey, entertain me, show me what you got, and then hopefully I'll find some form and find some teams or players that really kind of pull me in. But right now, I just couldn't see anything from this weekend. So my recommended game to watch is actually not a game. It's a new documentary. I have not seen it yet, but it's called Rooney, and it's available now on Amazon Prime Video. So this is one that was released, I think, a few weeks ago in England. Wayne Rooney kind of talking about his life in football and out of football. It looks really intriguing. It looks really well done. I think a lot of the reviews in the UK were really critically acclaimed. So this one's called Rooney, and it's on Amazon Prime. So I'm certainly going to be watching it this weekend when I have time. All right, let's move on to listener mailbag. This is in response to our discussion last week about Copa Libertadores and the CONMEBOL going ahead and creating a bunch of different packages to put out for bids, including a package that was going to be streaming only, as well as other packages which would be television too. So Dave Watts says, I think beIN Sports isn't the worst, but I continually have issues with their app. I wouldn't cry about Copa Libertadores going somewhere else. And historically speaking, Dave, you're right. I mean, like the beIN Sports Connect app is probably the worst app. It's been broken or it's been clunky. That's one of my favorite words. for probably a good 3 years, easily, maybe even more. So what ends up happening is if you want to watch stuff through beIN Sports Connect, which is their app, it's much better to watch it through Fubo, Fanatis sometimes, but Fubo would be the place where it's integrated directly into the Fubo app, and then you can pick and choose from all the different channels. But that's pretty sad, though, when your app is so clunky or there's been so many issues over the years. But
so it's funny you use that term, Chris, because on my drive to up the state last week, in addition to listening to podcasts, I talked to a prominent person in one of the big NISA clubs, and that person used that same exact term to tell me why they want NISA off of beIN. Their app is, quote, clunky, unquote. That's why I started laughing. That's the operative term. And you're not the only one using it. And this person was telling me they feel like people are consuming soccer, particularly lower division soccer, through apps now and through mobile devices. And the beIN app has made it very difficult for this person's club in NISA to be as seen as they think it would be seen. So criticizing the league for doing a deal with NISA when beIN's app is so user unfriendly and clunky, to use that person's term that you have also used.
If anything could probably best represent be in sports's current status. I think it's their app, which it's a mess. I mean, and that's the thing that's interesting, the two, Kartik, is I've heard from a lot of listeners and readers from around the world, and in the different regions in the world, they have a different beIN Sports Connect app, and that one runs smoothly. It's you can get the games. It's a great experience. But the one that they built for the US market, you mean half the time didn't work, or if it did work, there'd be error messages. I think for a while they were using Microsoft, was it Silverlight?
Silverlight, yeah.
Yeah, which I don't think is even around anymore. But
Fox used to use that as well.
Yeah, and so bad. And it's even worse than Fox Soccer Plus.
Let me ask you this, Chris. This is such an important question. I guess we've talked about it on the podcast before, but you would have more insight into this than I would. Why is beIN so different in the U.S. market than in other markets? Because people from Europe, particularly France, tell me great things about beIN and their coverage and the way they cover things and the way they produce things. So why is it so bad in this country when it's the same parent organization, same network?
I would say, I mean, my personal take on this would be that they've been mismanaged, that they've made a lot of mistakes, a lot of bad decisions, effectively going to war against Comcast and then DirecTV kind of followed suit and said, okay, well, if beIN Sports is not going to be on Comcast, then maybe we should pull it off DirecTV. I think they just made a catalog of bad decisions. I mean, the app is a good example. Is this app has been broken or basically non-working in a regular, consistent way for years. And everyone knows, okay, stay away from that app. Just don't use it because it's so bad. And I think the fact that that hasn't been fixed after what, probably a good 3 years of being awful, is a representation of, you mean they're just disorganized, mismanaged, and not making the right decisions. Johan says about the Copa Libertadores, he says, I know this is highly unlikely because of who the owner is, but could you see a scenario of Univision acquiring the rights to the Copa Libertadores? And Johan, I think so. I think if you had to look at all the different broadcasters out there who would be interested, especially with their new streaming service, VIX Plus, which is going to debut at the end of March, from the Spanish language side of things, Univision should be a slam dunk to get Copa Libertadores because they need content for their streaming service. They have several, they have all the TV channels. This would be a good addition to, a lot of the Liga MX games they have. The only concern with this is that then they don't have an English language partner. So who gets the English language rights? And could that be Paramount Plus, who are not really kind of that concerned about the Spanish language side of the business, as we see with the Champions League? I mean, basically Champions League goes to Univision, and then the English language goes to Paramount Plus.
And Serie A. I've gotten complaints now from multiple people who listen to this podcast, so I am paying attention. I've conversed with some of you directly that CBS has been very slow to activate their Spanish language rights for Serie A that they gain. So
yep.
That's another red flag in terms of CBS's commitment to the Latino or Spanish speaking audience.
Yeah, so I could see that, Johan, as far as that being what could happen. It could be Univision getting the Spanish language rights with a mixture of streaming and television on the Spanish side, and then somebody like Paramount Plus perhaps, or maybe Warner Media, that would go for the TV/ streaming service on the English language side. Next up is TK. TK wants to talk about away goals, the away goals rule. TK says, I know this wasn't discussed, but the away goals rule beIN abolished is interesting from the TV streaming viewership perspective. There is a debate about the fairness of it and the style of play. I don't think this has anything to do with the decision to change it. It was about keeping viewers watching and anticipating that the next goal changes the immediate live result. My hypothesis would be that people are prone to turn off or fast forward the game more often when there is a greater than one goal lead. That's interesting. That's an interesting take that I haven't seen or heard or read. Kartik, what do you think? Do you think there's anything to this?
Yeah, I want to wait for more data on the away goals rule and how it's affecting viewership and play. But it's very weird. It's a rule I hated. I thought it was one of the dumbest rules in any sport, the away goals rule, for years, and effectively skewed results and gave some goals double value. I mean, I think of even just most prominently maybe the Iniesta goal against Chelsea in 2009 in the match which we remember from Overboo, right, the official, that Chelsea felt they should have had four penalties. But that 90-plus-3-minute away goal had an outweighed impact on the result. But now that the away goals are gone, I think maybe tactically it's easier just to kind of sit back for the away team in opening legs. And the feeling is nil-nil is a good result. Now, to be honest with you, that had been kind of the mentality of many managers the last few years, like that nil-nil or 1-1 is a good result in the first leg. And even home teams had felt like nil-nil is a good result in the first leg, and then let's go and go get a 1-1 away, and then we can advance. So maybe it will encourage more attacking play from the home teams, but I don't know. I mean, it could affect viewership, because that away goal, I guess, was something that you would look for as a viewer, right? That was mm-hmm. something you would wait for, even if there were a 2 or 3 goal lead, because that away goal might be is effectively weighted more, right, in two-leg tie. Now that's gone, so I can see how it would affect streaming. However, I'm a person who embraced getting rid of it. I just have thought it's an awful rule for years, and have felt that it penalizes teams that are well-organized and defensive, which we all like good attacking football, but I still don't think that you should rig the rules. This is my big complaint about American sports. They keep rigging the rules in American sports, American football in particular, but also to a certain extent in basketball, to prohibit defensive play or to make it harder for defenders to defend and easier to encourage scoring. And soccer has never been like that, other than this away goals rule, which now that it's gone, I think it is fair. You know, we don't have as many nil-nil games as we did 20, 30 years ago. And in an era also where you give 3 points for a win, I think there's been enough done to encourage attacking play that you don't need that rule that I think is very punitive towards teams that may be more defensive.
I think one of the things, though, too, Kartik, is for new fans, so new soccer fans or people just watching soccer for the first time and watching the Champions League, and this could be globally, and somebody trying to, they're watching a game and saying, okay, what's the score? And then you have to explain, I mean, in previous seasons with the away goals, what that meant. It was a little bit confusing. You mean it was like, okay, what? Like, so if they score an away goal, that kind of carries more weight. So I think in some ways it simplifies things. You mean, and then the other thing though too is I agree with you too in terms of the data point of view. It's too early, and I think people were overreacting, especially after that PSG Real Madrid game that ended. Well, it looked like it was going to end 0-0. It looked like Real Madrid was kind of just playing to go ahead and just try to get a 0-0, and then PSG wins it at the end. But I think at the same time that game was going on, it was Sporting against Man City in Portugal, and Man City was winning, what, 5-0. So I think it's too early to kind of say that the away goals rule is a positive or a negative in terms of how the results are happening and the games are happening. But to TK's point, I think it does in some way probably encourage viewers to stick with the game where there is no away goals rule, where it could something crazy could happen at the end of the game that could turn the game upside down. And TV viewers always want to have people stuck to the game, watching it from minute zero all the way through to minute 90. So yeah, it could be TK, but we'll have to wait and see kind of what happens in the coming months or years to see really kind of what the effect is. So in regards to streaming, we had a really good conversation last week on the podcast about all our preferences or kind of intricacies about the different streaming services and what we liked and what didn't like. Loco Footy says, excellent. VIX, ESPN Plus, and Paramount Plus are going to go hard at this. bye-bye Be In Sports. I'm hoping that Fubo keeps their hands off other soccer rights. ESPN and Univision would probably look to grab both pay streaming packages to keep the exclusivity. VIX can be a huge player if they really want to. Ra says, Paramount Plus will get a dedicated sports section soon. How do I know this? I participate in their Paramount Insiders Market Research Platform, which I view as a more productive way to push my agenda. Full DVR controls and replays immediately after final whistle. Anyway, they recently requested feedback on their app redesign. All the concepts that they asked to evaluate had a dedicated sports section, and they already have a logo for it.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Rob. That's great news. And keep doing that good work. You're doing the work for all of us participating in that Market Insiders research platform.
Yeah. That's great to know. And it's a good heads up for myself and other listeners, too, that those things look like they're going to be coming soon. At least the new logo and a dedicated sports section and then maybe some of those other features. Mercator says, maybe it's just me, but ESPN Plus is by far the smartest app. It always has the live match I want available as the first or second item in the home screen. I think it's able to tell the teams I generally watch. It always gives me Frankfurt Bayern or Madrid Barca if they're playing. Always selects and elects matches first as well and suggests my specific college football team in the afternoons. ESPN Plus also pushes their own stuff. I'm always suggested MMA despite never watching, and is basically useless for non-live events. I don't even bother trying to watch ESPN FC in the ESPN app. I can never find it. I just watch it on Hulu, and Hulu also still seems to be able to get around the local blackouts. I was able to watch an in-market NHL game last week. Peacock is by far the worst. I only watch the Premier League, and I always have to go to the sports tab, then scroll three or four times to get to the Premier League hub. But it is indeed 60 frames per second, so I will give it a break for now. So Mercator, you have to give us your secrets about how you get ESPN Plus to be so smart, because as we talked about last week, Swansea's my favorite team. Some of those games are on ESPN Plus. It never, hardly ever does it get to the top row, to the first or second item. I have to scroll to the right, keep on searching, or go down and find the championship kind of league icon and click on that and then find it. But that's interesting, though, too, Kartik. Anything else you can take from that in terms of what Mercator said about some of the apps and how they work?
That's all really quite interesting, and I've had the same experience where they know what to recommend for me, which is to me pretty significant in terms of ESPN Plus.
Having said that, though, too, I know Fubo has, like, so when you log into Fubo, sometimes it asks you, like, hey, what's your favorite league so we can go ahead, favorite team in the league so that we can go ahead and make sure that your content is, you mean, that you serve it up higher up on the page. And for me, it has, I mean, it has NFL, NBA, I mean, it goes down the list, NHL, etc., MLS, Premier League, and then that's it. And I'm like, okay, none of those apply to me. Yes, I do like watching those different leagues, but I don't have any favorite teams in those. And then, so if I'm a fan of the championship, well, no, if I support a team that's in the championship, which I do, there's no option for that. So every single time that question comes up, I usually kind of try to skip that, but it keeps on asking that same question maybe every few weeks, which is kind of irritating on that one. JP says, if ESPN's algorithm is becoming smarter, I haven't seen it yet. Yes, I will also be bombarded on the app on Saturday mornings with Bundesliga if opening it around 9 a.m. Eastern. I also will be bombarded with multiple college sports if opening it later in the afternoon. They just show what they consider the most prominent live events at the time, and there isn't much besides soccer on weekend mornings. In every case, what I historically watch more of, which is the Belgian League, is pushed towards the very end of the live or featured scroll. And that's what I want to know from Mercator. Like, what's his secret to success? Is Mercator watching it on a mobile device or on an app, or even, there's got to be some reasons why that experience is so different from one user to the next. And same for you and I, Kartik. I think we get different experiences too. We also talked about Major League Soccer last week, about the push to get a team in Las Vegas. And also, I think it was Chris's experience about thinking that MLS probably may not do so well in Las Vegas, just because you always see Liga MX shirts or European soccer shirts on the strip. Greg says, you can't judge anything about Las Vegas by just looking at what's on the strip. My understanding is that locals don't really go there except if friends or relatives are in town. So the jerseys you see are likely more indicative of who's visiting. And it's entirely possible that, as with Miami, I lived there for a few years, certain weeks are heavy on people from certain countries because of tourism packages. Some weeks in South Beach were Germany weeks. Some weeks were France weeks. Maybe that week was a big Mexico week, or lots of Mexicans from the LA area. Or a foreign tourist week. I doubt those were locals on the strip. Craig Burley, on the topic of, kind of you and I defending him and what he said about Chelsea and Man City and the FIFA Club World Cup and the Premier League and kind of the hierarchy of what's most important to clubs in England. Dave says, I especially like the segment at the end where you discussed Craig Burley's argument that the Premier League is more important than the Club World Cup. Part of the fun of sports is we all value and enjoy different things. Soccer has so many competitions to root for year-round. We may all have our own hierarchy of what to watch and how to value results. I am aligned with Craig on this topic. Also, to echo another commenter, kudos to both you and Kartik on your openness to get talk about multiple perspectives. The internet was a lot more fun when that mindset was more prevalent. And last but not least, we got two pieces of feedback from Chris and RJ about the upcoming World Cup this year. Chris says, hi guys, I want to give you credit on the new website. It looks great and is easy to navigate. A few days ago, I talked with a friend who is a casual soccer fan and really watches when the World Cup takes place. One of the big concerns that he discussed with me about this year's World Cup is how Fox is going to cover the tournament while also covering the NFL and college football. With that in mind, my question to either of you is, how do you think Fox will be able to cover the World Cup while also showing NFL and college football? And then RJ says, great job with the show. With Qatar 2022 rapidly approaching, do you have any insight into Fox's plans? Will they be sending crews to Qatar? Any guesses on the play-by-play and analyst teams? So, Kartik, with the World Cup, most of the games, because of the different time zone in the Middle East, most of the games for us in the US on the East Coast, games will begin at 5 a.m. Eastern. So I think it's like 5, 8, 10, or maybe 11 and 2. So it goes, actually, I think it goes from 5 a.m. to about 2 p.m. Eastern time. So it's a solid, God, 9 hours of games. So I think, to me personally, in terms of NFL, that could lead right into some NFL broadcasts, especially if it's on a Sunday. College football, that's going to be a little bit difficult in terms of what Fox has the rights to, which I don't even know. But there might be some games that will be on, say, FS2 or FS1, and then the big ones are on Fox for the World Cup. But
I guess I don't know. It is worrying. I mean, this is something that I think we've been concerned about since they formally moved the World Cup to the winter, right?
Yeah.
With Fox's heavy schedule on other things. And Fox was not heavy into college football when they got the World Cup rights as they are now. So it's a big concern.
Yeah, and I guess RJ's question to you about, like, kind of in terms of insight into Fox's plans, will they be sending crews? Any guesses on the play-by-play and all that? A lot of this hinges on the U.S. qualifying for this World Cup, because, we've been talking for the last probably 2 years saying, like, hey, guys, there's no guarantee that the U.S. is going to qualify for this World Cup. Yes, they have some strong younger stars coming through the system, but it's not a given. We still have to qualify. And even at this stage, too, with three more games to go, the U.S. sitting in a pretty good position, but there's still a lot of work to be done. I think it's too early to talk about Fox's plans, because if for some reason the U.S. did not qualify, Fox would change their plans completely. Now, if they did qualify, I mean, that changes things too in terms of how much budget, how much talent they'd be sending over to the Middle East, and how much commitment that there would be. So it's a risky period to kind of try to even guess what they would do, because they're not even sure themselves, I'm sure. But Kartik, I mean, talking about all of this, I mean, the big question this week was Weston McKennie, who got injured in the Juventus-Villarreal game, is going to be out for 8 to 10 weeks with a fractured foot. I know you're a big fan, but how does that impact this US team? I mean, do you think that, I mean, who steps up? I mean, can this team get through the next three games without him?
To be honest, Chris, I'm a big fan of his in terms of his play. I'm tired of spending weeks of club football talking about national teams. So I haven't thought about it, okay, quite honestly. And I maybe I'll think about it when the March international break rolls around. Maybe I won't. This has become a thing in the U.S. where, like, every single club match or every single thing that happens from a club perspective in Europe is analyzed through the lens of the U.S. men's national team. And I'm tired of it. Well, I just want to enjoy club football.
Yeah, well, that I get. That I get totally in terms of that gets tiresome because – I mean, there's a lot of reporters out there that are like, I mean, it could be Chelsea against Liverpool playing this weekend, and it's Christian Pulisic against Liverpool. I'm like,
yeah,
there's no guarantee he's going to start. Now, more recently, he's been playing better, so yeah, he probably would get a start. No guarantee. But it's not one individual player who's American.
Or if someone gets hurt on some team, it's how does it impact this American? If this guy gets hurt, how does it? It's so tiresome and boring. So I haven't thought about it. Obviously, McKennie, I think, is the U.S.'s best player by a pretty wide distance. So it's going to impact them. But I can't think about who steps up. I mean, I would assume Kellen Acosta would be the first guy you call. But I haven't really thought about it, to be honest with you, until this moment.
That's okay. Yeah, the reason I ask the question too is because not so much about the U.S. men's national team, but just because of more so the impact on Fox Sports' coverage of the World Cup later this year, which is a shame too, because if the U.S. whether the U.S. qualifies or not, Fox should still give the same level of commitment to covering the world's event. It's not the USA World Cup. It is the World Cup of the best teams from around the world. But me personally, I think, Weston McKennie, to me, has been leading this team on the pitch, has been scoring the big goals, and has been the difference maker. And I even Kellen Acosta kind of taking that spot, he's no Weston McKennie, and I'm worried. I'm really worried because
so interestingly enough, just one U.S. men's national team note: in the midst of all the Ukraine coverage I've been watching on the BBC, they had a scroll on their crawl on the BBC World Service World News about Yunus Musah and his development for Valencia, and apparently during the sports segment they were doing something on it. This was earlier in the week. So there is him also, who's emerging and will probably be a better player come November in the World Cup than he's been in the last 6 months, right? He's a young player who's consistently getting better. And as I said, the BBC has even noticed. I think their angle was that he was obviously a British-raised player that grew up in England. But so that was interesting. I didn't see the feature, but it was on the crawl while I'm watching coverage of Putin invading Ukraine. So he's getting noticed, and he's a midfielder for the U.S.
All right, listeners, if you have something to say, something to ask us, we'd love to read your comment out on air. You can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. So episode 1,400 is in the can. What you don't know, Kartik, is that we've gotten a couple of people to actually share some feedback through audio. So I'll add that to this segment here. But we heard from David Marcy, Statman Marcy, who sent us some audio greetings, and also Morgan Green, Who also shared some of his memories of working on the podcast and some of the kind of basically kind of his feelings about hitting that 1,400 milestone mark. So, yeah, so best definitely check that out. And thanks to Statman Mossy and to Morgan for sharing their thoughts about hitting episode 1,400. Now, Kartik, heading into another weekend, opening weekend for MLS, big games around Europe, a lot of things happening in the world, as you mentioned. And what are you going to do and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.
Hey, guys, Statman Mossy here. Congratulating you guys on an incredible milestone, 16 years, 1,400 episodes. That is ridiculous. I don't even remember where I was in 2006. But I am glad that I got to play a small part in this. I remember there was a season in which I came on every week to talk about the Premier League with you guys and Nick Webster and others. I also did an interview with Nate Abudeya once. I'm not sure if that counts towards this tally, but nevertheless, congrats again. Keep up the great work. I'm sure you guys are going to keep doing this for many, many more years.
Hey, Gaffer, congratulations on 1,400 episodes of the World Soccer Talk podcast. That is a heck of a number when you really think about it, and personally, I am very proud and very honored to have been a part of just a few of those episodes myself. I had so much fun doing the podcast, just everything that went into it from the production angle, getting multiple guys together on multiple continents and through multiple time zones, all to put out a product that we were all very proud of and that is still going today and going strong. It's something that still warms my heart. It was some of the most fun I've ever had, not just in sports media, but watching soccer and being around fellow soccer lovers like Kartik and Chris and Lawrence and Matt. So just wanted to say thank you so much for allowing me to be part of the history of the World Soccer Talk pod, and here's to 1,400 more. Congratulations.